She reduces, reuses, and recycles. She talks the talk and walks the walk. She doesn't tell you what to think. She just wants you to. She's Mrs. Green. And this is Mrs. Green's World on the Mrs. Green's World Radio Network. And now, Mrs. Green.
Welcome, everybody. You are indeed listening to the Mrs. Green's World Radio Network, where we don't tell you what to think. We just want you to. And certainly, one more time, we are going to give you a lot to think about today. Great things to think about. The sponsor for today's show is the University of Arizona. And I would say without hesitation that they are internationally recognized for their meaningful and really important work in every possible area of sustainability and addressing global challenge that I could think of. So I am very pleased to have as my guest one of the people who's responsible for that reputation, the University of Arizona's Dr. Rafe Sagarin, who is the program manager at Biosphere 2 Ocean, Institute of the Environment, and one of the authors of one of my favorite books. And I've said this on many shows, and I mean that, Learning from the Octopus. And I learned from the octopus. Rafe, thanks for being here. It's great to have you with us again.
It's great to be here again.
It is really exciting, especially since I just went to Biosphere 2. So I'm like ready to get on with this interview. A very relevant message that I share each week about one of our national sponsors, Ecobella. And the more radio shows I do and the more people I get to meet from around the country, the more important it becomes to me on a daily basis to think about the purchasing power to support businesses that are in the United States, based in the United States, U.S.-based companies like Ecobella. They have cruelty-free organic cosmetics and natural skincare products, and they're outstanding. Their commitment to environmental practices are stellar, and they support the four-leggeds. And I'm just going to give you one example that I haven't said on the show very much. They have an Invincible Spirit Award that recognizes acts of kindness towards animals. And like, how many companies do you know that sell skincare products do that? They're outstanding. Please check them out, Ecobella with two C's. And remember that by purchasing products from Ecobella, you're supporting an American-based company, and that's really important, everybody. You got to love it. So once again, join me in welcoming Dr. Rafe Sagarin, Professor, Program Manager, Biosphere 2 Ocean Institute of the Environment, Marine Biologist, author of a great book, Learning from the Octopus. So Rafe, let's hear about what's going on. I think the great place to start is, if people don't know what Biosphere 2 that are listening from around the world don't know, paint us a picture for that. It's a mecca in the middle of the desert.
Yeah, Biosphere 2 is just an amazing place. And I've only started working there a few months ago, so I'm still just in that awestruck place.
You're still learning where, how to get around it?
Oh, absolutely. You can really get lost in there. It's a 3.15-acre greenhouse in the desert. It was originally built to be a self-sustaining model of the entire Earth system, or Biosphere 1. That's our Earth. Biosphere 2 is the recreation of that. And the University of Arizona has just taken ownership of Biosphere 2 to use not as a sealed self-sustaining ecosystem, but as a platform for large-scale research on our Earth system, and a place that anyone can come visit and learn about the research we're doing, learn about the history of the biosphere, and learn about what's going on with our planet right now.
And I remember from the last show that you were on that you were a tide pool kid. You learned and got your passion and your energy and your excitement from tide pools, a large part of it. So when I saw that you were getting to be the head of Biosphere 2 Ocean, I thought, this has got to be a dream come true. So let's talk about, what is your vision for Biosphere 2 Ocean?
Well, it really comes, you know, from the heart for me, being someone who loves the ocean. And when I'm here at the University of Arizona, I spend a lot of time in the Sea of Cortez or Gulf of California. And then I saw that up at Biosphere 2, there's this huge ocean environment under the glass, 700,000-gallon ocean. But it hasn't been used a lot recently for research or for discovering the oceans, or especially for talking to our visitors about the fact that even though we are in the desert, our biology, our climate, even our culture is deeply affected by the proximity to this Gulf of California, just a few hours down the road. So I saw a beautiful opportunity to show the connections between the desert and the sea right inside the biosphere too.
And we can't survive without that ocean here in the, I mean, in that whole Sea of Cortez. It's like a, they're inextricably bound. But what are some of the things that to me, the biosphere was is an ongoing experiment. So there are no mistakes. There's just ongoing learning. But what are some of the things that the designers of the original of this vast structure did not take into consideration that you're going to have to?
Well, there's a lot of difficulties about trying to recreate an ocean in a much, much smaller space, because the real ocean gets inputs from all over the place. For good or bad, that's one of the reasons we have a big gyre of trash in the Pacific, is because it's getting that trash from all over the world and collecting it there. But it also gets a lot of energy and resources from all over the world, where oceans are moving that energy around. You can't do that in a much smaller space. And for example, the original corals that were in the original biosphere ocean did not thrive because the glass on the biosphere was treated to keep out UV radiation. That protected the people who lived in the biosphere, but the corals actually need that UV radiation. So that was one area where we learned that coral reefs are incredibly difficult to replicate. And we certainly learned that there's not a lot of prospects for growing coral in a laboratory or in an enclosed biome if we want to replace coral that's damaging in the ocean. So that was a big lesson we learned. As you said, there's no mistakes. We learned a huge lesson there about the complexity. One of the things that we can do with this vision to transform this ocean into a living model of the Gulf of California, which is what I want to do, is we can allow the temperature of the water in the biosphere ocean to float or go up and down with the environmental temperature, because the Gulf of California actually goes through a wide range of temperatures. A coral reef has a very narrow range of temperature, and that takes a lot of energy to put into the ocean to keep the temperature in that narrow band that coral reefs need to live. So now we're able to expand that range of temperature, which means that we'll have to put a lot less energy into the ocean, so it itself becomes more sustainable. And then we'll be talking about the sustainability of the larger ocean out there.
And even going back to my recent trip, some of the things that are, to me, I call the evolution of Biosphere 2, we were in the rainforest. I mean, you go from the ocean to the desert to the rainforest, and it was just, it's remarkable. And our fabulous tour guide, I'm now president of his fan club, Franklin, said that they are going to, at the Biosphere, another part of it, I won't get off on that tangent, but that you're going to lower the temperatures in there, not chill, cool it as much, so that it really mimics the hydration that might happen in the desert, and then learn from that. So the ocean, complex carbohydrate, many parts, and it's warmer in some places, and then you wait for the ocean breezes, which you would have to create in there. So what are some of the kinds of things literally that you're going to do?
Well, we want visitors from the moment they walk into Biosphere, and when you go on the tour, you go into the habitat where people used to live in the Biosphere, and then you go into the living habitats where there's the rainforest, the savanna, and the first place you go is a walkway over the ocean. And what I want is for people immediately to see the connection between the desert and the sea. So we hope to build up an island in the middle of the ocean that'll have cactuses and other desert plants living on it, just as you would see if you went down to the islands in the Gulf of California. So you immediately have that sense of what's going on, so you could see it from the surface. But we also have what we call the Ocean Viewing Gallery below the ocean, and we're right now renovating that, bringing in some really cool new exhibits about the history of the Gulf of California. And that has large windows that look into the ocean. And so through those windows, you'll be able to see the living species, amazing fish, beautiful invertebrates like starfish and anemones and sea urchins, that'll really be quite spectacular, especially for so many of our school kids who come who have never been to the ocean and may never have an opportunity to go to the ocean, they can see a replica of the ocean, and really a replica of their ocean, the one that's so close to home that they haven't seen right in Biosphere 2.
And even the way it is now, I want to represent the diversity that was with my group in terms of age. We had little boys and one little girl who was really little, and then up to me, I'm sure I was the oldest, and the interest, the excitement around the water. I mean, the kids were just enthralled from Hello, but the excitement around the water was really, I mean, it's a magical thing for kids to have happen. What are you going to do to address things like, again, Franklin said, the timing of this interview is so perfect that the algae has taken over. So do you have to empty the whole thing? What are you going to I have to ask this horrible question.
Right now, my whole job, this first year of being on board, is to bring together all the greatest, most creative minds I can in aquarium science, in animal husbandry, in design, in engineering, and bring them together to think, what is the best way to make that transformation? So we can work a lot on the water quality as it is, but we think that probably the best way to do this is to bring the water down, take the water out, and rebuild it from the bottom. But that raises a challenge. What do you do with 700,000 gallons of salt water? So I've gotten a lot of good input about what are some of the opportunities. And so it could be everything from start a kind of aquaculture project to see, okay, well, we have a big pool of water that we could store somewhere and see, can we do a more sustainable version of aquaculture? Or it could be about looking at desalinization technology, which is hugely important, not just on the coast, but inland here on our Indian reservations, where even their underground water supplies are way too saline. So we could look at making it a test bed for testing that technology. And then some of the minerals that we could actually essentially mine out of this salt water could be valuable for other processes. So we can be talking about an emerging idea about what's called urban mining, which is the fact that there is tons of rare earth minerals and other elements in our environment all around us, where that may help us not have to dig up another mountaintop to get our mines, but they're all around us. We just have to figure out how to extract them. So there's lots of different possibilities at this point, and that's why this is such a fun project and why I'm taking input from as many smart people as I can get around me. And I have to say, there's a huge amount of enthusiasm, not just within the Biosphere 2 staff, but with lots of people around the world that I'm talking to about this, people like the people who designed the Monterey Bay Aquarium, which is a fabulous kind
of
institute.
One of the best.
Yeah. So we're really looking far and wide for the best ideas of how to do this transformation.
And the marine life that'll be in there will be the marine life that's found in the Sea of Cortez and in the Gulf. That's not any invasive like species.
No, we're looking at what are the species in the Gulf, and we have such a rich body of species to look at because there are so many species in the Gulf, and many of them are endemic, which means that they only live in the Gulf of California. So to show those in our what we're calling the Desert Sea is really going to be spectacular.
And I think that's a really great name for it, the Desert Sea. I mean, it gives you a picture of there is something there in the desert, and having the surroundings about it, it's unbelievable. So what are some of the biggest, I want to know the timeline too. Like when can we expect, just tell me in your best possible scenario, when we would have an ocean view to go out there and see that's the new ocean?
Well, what I love about this project is it's a huge project. And we don't shy away from big projects at Biosphere 2.
Ever
the original
evolving.
Biosphere 2 was an enormous, unprecedented undertaking. So we have no fear about that. But it's a project that can be done in stages. So right now, as we speak, your friend Franklin and I yesterday were just moving museum pieces around. We're renovating the Ocean Viewing Gallery, which had gotten quite outdated, and it didn't really tell a consistent story. It told a lot of different stories about the environment, about the history of the ocean. We're going to tell this one story about the connection between the desert and the sea in this ocean viewing gallery, which we should be ready to reopen really in probably a few months.
That's amazing.
What we're doing is very quick turnaround, what we can do at a low budget. And we have a donation from my friend Nancy Burnett of her exhibit called Return to the Sea of Cortez, which is about a scientific expedition that I was a part of, where in 2004, we went back to the exact same sites that the expedition of the author John Steinbeck and his best friend, who was a marine biologist named Ed Ricketts, went to in 1940. So they went to a bunch of sites in the Sea of Cortez in 1940. We went back in 2004 and to see how things had changed. And Nancy made a beautiful exhibit about that, which right now we're hanging in the Ocean Visitors Gallery and hope to have open to our visitors by the new year. So look out for that, because that's going to be a fun way to start to tell the story of this transformation. And what we're going to tell is that the history of the biosphere ocean and the history of the real ocean are working in parallel. So the biosphere ocean started with a grand vision of this coral reef, which was full of life. The ocean, especially the Gulf of California, when visitors first went there, when Steinbeck and Ricketts went there in 1940, they saw this endless bounty that could never be exhausted. And yet, here we are, 60 years later, in the case of the biosphere, 20 years later, and our ocean, as you mentioned, is kind of just covered in algae. We have a few of the original species left, but it's in a low state. Likewise, the Gulf of California is in what I hope is a low state. There's a lot of places where the fish have been taken out, where pollution has affected them. But the third part of this story is the hopeful future. The hopeful future for the biosphere is this transformed ocean that we're building, hopefully over the next couple of years. And the transformed future of the Gulf of California is all these amazing restoration projects that are coming from the ground up, from little organizations like SADO in Puerto Peñasco.
Well, the SADO.
Our great friends there. And from organizations really all over the Gulf that are citizen-driven, that are scientist-driven, that are driven in conjunction with fishermen and people who work in the Gulf, that are all working to rebuild the Gulf. So we're telling this parallel story in the biosphere. And as for the large transformation, another one of my jobs is really just raising funds to make that happen, because it's a big project, and that's what I'm starting to get going with. And what I am very inspired by is how excited everyone I talk to about this project is. So we're even looking into doing a crowdfunded way of raising money for this on Rocket Hub, where we'll go out to anyone who's interested in conservation of the oceans and say, be a part of this project, help us build it. Which is something that's fairly new for the university. So that's an exciting innovation that we're bringing to this project.
And it's so a sign of the times. People want to do that. I mean, Kickstarter and Indiegogo. I never heard of this one. It's another one. Why would you pick that one? I love it. It's called what?
Rocket Hub.
Rocket Hub.
The reason I picked it, and this is, again, very ground up and organic, is I had a wonderful student who at Duke University when I taught there, and she got out of school and wanted to continue her research on seahorses. So she started a couple of years ago a Rocket Hub project on seahorses, and she raised more than the amount of money she needed to go around the world studying seahorses. So I thought, if she could do it, we can do it. And we're educating the university about getting out there and going to the crowd and seeing what they think about our projects. So hopefully we'll launch that pretty soon.
And when we come back, we have to take a short break. I'd like to talk a little bit about the challenges of funding, which I think are you'll be able to do that because it is so topical. The oceans are at such serious risk. And then the other thing is, in the designing of this, who's your demographic? Who's your target market? Is it educators? Is it researchers? Is it students? Is it all of the above? And how, in the the conceptual design, how do you integrate that into the thinking? So everybody, we are going to take a short break. Time is flying because we are having fun. With me in studio today is Dr. Rafe Sagarin. He is the program manager, Biosphere 2 Ocean, and I love to pause there, Institute of the Environment, author of one of my favorite books, Learning from the octopus. And Rafe, if we have time, which I think we will, let's do in the last part of the show, talk a little bit about learning from the octopus, because I have lots of new listeners, and it's so relevant to me that you wrote that book. It's not the only book you've written, but it's the only one I've read, and how it was almost like you had a vision for this, and maybe you didn't know that it was going to end up happening and all unfolding at Biosphere 2. I think we're really blessed to have it. So everybody stay here with me. You're listening to the Mrs. Green's World Radio Network. We don't tell you what to think. We just want you to, and lots more to think about when we come back after the break.
In the mid-Tucson summer, you would expect it to be over 100 degrees. But deep beneath the University of Arizona's compost heap, temperatures can hit 160. Started by the Compost Cats student group, the U of A Compost Project is collecting tons of waste from around campus and keeping it out of landfills. Gathering garbage and converting it into a useful product for the community? Now that's a hot idea indeed. The University of Arizona. Big questions, bold solutions, better tomorrows.
Hi there, this is Mrs. Green. Fuel efficiency is picking up speed thanks to the new 48 turbocharged miles per gallon Volkswagen Jetta Hybrid. When you hear numbers like 48 highway miles per gallon and 42 city miles per gallon, you might think the Jetta Hybrid is more about fuel efficiency than fun. But for all its good looks and eco-responsibility, this Jetta gets its power from a turbocharged engine capable of 170 horsepower. And when you experience its ultra-fast 7-speed DSG automatic transmission, you'll realize that the Jetta has a lot more going on under the hood than your average hybrid. Yes, this new Jetta is quick and fun to drive, but it's still got the incredible efficiency you'd expect from a hybrid. How fuel efficient is it? Well, all you need to do is look, because each VW hybrid shows your energy usage and driving range on its touchscreen display. When you see how much fuel you're saving, you'll be pleasantly surprised by how economical this little speed demon can be. Please visit Chapman Volkswagen at 4500 East 22nd Street in Tucson or ChapmanTucson.com to find out more.
You can always find things around the house to give to Goodwill, but I have a bigger reason to give. A while back, I lost my job and I couldn't even support my family. A lot of people don't know Goodwill can help you find a job, but that's what they did for me. I've had this job for 7 years, and I love going to work. You know how they say Goodwill changes lives? Well, it's true. Goodwill needs your donations now more than ever. Please donate today.
Bookman Sports Exchange is now open at 3330 East Speedway. We're taking our passion and experience of buying, selling, and trading books and music and applying it to the world of sporting goods, outdoor, and fitness gear. We are giving you another way to save money on the things that you love, Bookman style. Remember, Bookman Sports Exchange, sporting goods, outdoor, and fitness gear, now open daily from 9 a.m. to 10 p.m. on Speedway east of Country Club. Check out bookmans.com for more info.
Welcome back, everybody. You're listening to the Mrs. Green's World Radio Network, where we don't tell you what to think. We just want you to. Thanks for being a part of the show today. Thanks for listening. I appreciate all of you and your reaching out to me about the shows and your wonderful comments that I get. Our in-studio guest today is Dr. Rafe Sagarin. He's the program manager, Biosphere 2 Ocean, Institute of the Environment, and author of one of my favorite books. I don't get tired of saying that, Learning from the Octopus, and maybe we'll talk about that in the last segment of the show, because it is so relevant to your life's journey and what you're doing to make a difference for the planet. It's all part of the big plan. Okay, you talked about it a little bit in the first segment, but there are really three parts to the story that you will be telling. So tell us what those three parts are and how almost complicated or complex it makes it because of the intricacies of those three parts.
Well, the story of Biosphere 2 Ocean is really the same story that we see in the real ocean, especially a place like the Gulf of California, where people once viewed oceans as bountiful and endless and full of everything we ever needed. And we're just now realizing that they're not endless and that we can really bring about their demise. And that's sort of the low ebb of the story. And then the part that really gets me excited and keeps me as an optimist is that both in the biosphere with this great complicated ocean system we have, and in the real Gulf of California, which is even more complex, we have a hopeful future because so many people are committed or are becoming committed to protecting it, restoring it, and really understanding that it's not something to take lightly, that it's something we really need to care for to ensure that we have all of that bounty of the sea into the future.
You know, I had Andy Sharpless on the show from Oceana, and he too painted a picture of hope and pointed out that 60% of the world's protein comes from the ocean. So if we go down, lots of people are going down, because you think of massive cultures that their primary source of protein is fish. Now, speaking of the fish, this is one of Mrs. Green's random thoughts that I have to ask you. I, of course, painfully watched the controversial show Blackfish. So when you're getting fish there, I know you're not going to have dolphins doing tricks, okay? I'm not worried about that. But to me, what you're doing is so important that you have to get in the story why the beauty of the sea is so important. And at the same time, letting people know we're in trouble, folks. I mean, the oceans, to me, are at serious risk. And there are two now huge plastic gyres floating. There's not one, there are two, and they're growing, you know, and I don't get it. So how are you, you know, making sure all that ethical part is, and I know you will, but also that other part of the message, like this is, look how beautiful this is, folks. You need to leave here and do something about it.
Well, I think there's a lot built into the project that we want to do at Biosphere that touches on all of those things, because you know, the defense of keeping orcas in tanks and doing tricks is that it'll inspire people to take care of the ocean somehow, except that it doesn't really show how an orca really lives or the environment that they live in. I find that people who see any sort of sea creatures in their natural environment, in their natural ecosystem, are far more inspired.
They're mesmerized
to take care of the ocean. And you don't need a whale jumping through hoops to show that. Even a beautiful little starfish that is completely content in a 700,000-gallon ocean, or a fish that normally spends its entire life, some of the reef fish spend their entire life in a 20-foot square area, even out in the wild. Those are species that I feel ethically okay about holding in a large ecosystem tank like we have, but then we're showing the whole habitat. And it's really the Monterey Bay Aquarium that turned the corner on this, because they were the first aquarium to show a local ecosystem, an entire ecosystem with their kelp forest tank that was also local. And everyone said, you can't do it, you can't do it. And it took the genius of David Packard to say, no, this could be a compelling thing. And what you found is that started kind of a revolution in how we display sea creatures, that we put them in their natural environment and show people that they're all connected to everything else living around them. And you have to see that whole thing. And to me, that's the inspirational story. I think and I hope that the model of putting one big charismatic animal in a tiny tank and having it do tricks is on the way out, because I don't think that's the way you inspire people to protect the real ocean.
One can only hope, Rafe, that it's really on the way out. It was very, very, very disturbing to me. And I had, you know, I took my kids to SeaWorld 25 years ago, and I'm telling you, my grandkids, it's not on our list. Let's just say that. What about the things that I think you're doing really well? And it's not just about Bio2 Ocean, but there is so much talk about the gap that's widening between the haves and the have-nots. So at the Biosphere, you want kids, you know, you talked about one of your students that started Rocket Hub, mm-hmm. which I love. So you planted a seed in her. It was wonderful. The little boy that got down, scooted down as soon as he got in the ocean view last week, was really excited. He started throwing rocks. There, even with the way it looks now, we got down there and everybody went, it was kind of like, oh, because it smelled like the ocean. There's enough little waves. So what are you doing, long question, the biosphere has special ways to get kids there in underfunded school systems, in, you know, the foothills kids can get their moms to take the vans. I mean, let's be honest, and take the vans out there on a field trip. If you're at another high-risk school in a very, you know, poor area, how are you helping to bridge that? Because I know you, and I know you will care.
Yeah, well, it's a huge issue with us, the whole issue of K-12 STEM education in science, technology, engineering, math, and getting especially students from these underrepresented populations. For one thing, almost all students in Arizona are underrepresented with experiences with the ocean. So to me, getting any student here to experience the ocean and understand a little more about it is a victory. But especially those students who, as you say, have many fewer opportunities because they don't have a parent who's free to drive them out there, and that kind of thing. So we work with any kind of school to try to make a situation where they can get out the transport out to Biosphere 2, that when they come out there, they're going to be immersed in an amazing experience. And you mentioned Franklin Lane, one of our interpretive specialists, who's also developing curriculum that's standards-based that teachers can get right in and check off those boxes they have to check off, but shows the students a way to learn science using the ocean, using their own creativity. So we don't just have canned experiences, but we have them try to make some of the experimental units, the collectors and that kind of thing, so that they can experience all the complexity of trying to be a marine scientist. And that's one of the beautiful things about the biosphere ocean is that it's in this sweet spot in the middle between a laboratory where you can control everything,
right,
but isn't very much like the real world, and the real world, which is incredibly complex, but also incredibly uncontrolled and also a little dangerous when you're talking about the ocean. The Biosphere 2 ocean kind of has both those aspects. We can control things about it. We can change the temperature. We can change the salinity. We have the kind of control and safety that you need when you have school groups out there. We can test new technologies there. We're just talking today about creating a challenge for different schools to create low-cost, remote-operated vehicles, ROVs as they're known in the trade, that can be basically submarines that can drive around the Biosphere 2 ocean and take data that the students can then use to study different scientific questions. And that's a challenge we're going to put out to public schools around Arizona.
I want to be on the Virgin Voyage.
So there's so many ways that we can use this to do just that kind of outreach.
And another thing that you do that I asked, it was not really a loaded question, Moses Thompson from Monzo Elementary School here in Tucson, that I love to give a plug to. It won the Greenest School in America Award by the United States Green Building Council. So they got a lot of national attention, which is helping them. But those kids, when you talk about the integrated learning approach, those kids have aquaponics at Monzo. So they were engaged already because they have a living laboratory with chickens. I was so happy out there too. What a day that was for me. And the greenhouse, and they have tilapia. And to see these little boys talk about catching the little fish and the temperature of the organic compound. So integrating that with Biosphere 2 ocean, to me, is it's built in for places like that. The other thing that he told me, that a shout out for Biosphere, is there was a teacher night, and our teachers are underpaid. And he went out there, and if you went and you paid the price of admission, I think you could get a year membership. Well, he's going to bring more people out there that'll, you know, pay admission, and that will. So those are some of the things that I think you're doing that are wonderful.
One of Biosphere 2's big success stories this fall was we finally have enough committed people that we could run a series of discovery nights. So the last Saturday in September and every Saturday in October, we open the Biosphere at night, which is an incredible experience. And we had different thematic nights, and one of the nights was a teacher appreciation night. And we hope that we'll be able to repeat those kind of events in the spring. And like you say, when people see it and go out there, They tell their friends about it. They tell other school groups about it if they're a teacher that took a school group. So we are building up a lot of momentum up there in Biosphere, and it's just wonderful to be a part of.
And I will not be signing up for the night tour of the rainforest. Franklin gave us a warning about that, and he says everything that goes creepy in the night is
a lot of creepy crawlers come out in the night.
And I said, no, I'll be busy that night. I'll be looking at the oceans because it's safer there. What are some of the, you know, there's such a competition out there in the world of research and development for good projects in terms of funding. So what is your plan, not to name specific funders you might be going after, but you never know. Someone could be listening to Mrs. Green's World and say, this is a relevant project, but what is the type of, is it going to be grants and foundations? Is it going to be patrons? You know, Ed Bass, founder of Biosphere 2, has been unbelievable in what he's done. So who are you looking for, and is it D, all of the above?
Well, one of the biggest challenges of the Biosphere 2 ocean and our transformation of it is also the biggest opportunity, which is that we have to, because of the mission of Biosphere 2, balance the research mission, the outreach mission, which is spreading science and science stories to our visitors, and the educational mission. So I need to think about how I can do all of those things in there. But that's an opportunity because people, foundations, and science funding institutes kind of play in all those different areas. So I've already gone to some foundations and said, here's a great educational opportunity. We've gone to the Office of Naval Research, has a big STEM research proposal. We've just put in a proposal to them for just for our STEM research side of it. We've gone to other foundations that are really interested in kind of kickstarting scientific projects that aren't quite ready for the level of National Science Foundation funding, but need a little start. And that's right where we are right now. So we've gone to those foundations. So we really have a lot of avenues to go at. And we'll also go after big individual donors who just want to fund a wholly unique project that's found nowhere else in the world. And there's really no other place from a visitor outreach standpoint, from a STEM teaching standpoint, and from a research standpoint where we can do what we can do with the Biosphere Ocean, because no one since the late 1980s, when Ed Bass and his colleagues had this vision to create Biosphere 2, has been able to replicate it. And it's one of the most remarkable things about Biosphere 2 is that it's still the only place on Earth that has such a large-scale approach to all different ecosystems of the Earth. And so we can do science there that you can't do anywhere else.
And, you know, he was obviously a visionary. He is a visionary, an early, you know, early adopter. Now more than ever, because of all of the things that hopefully people are more aware of with climate change, with the state of the oceans, to me, it's even more topical. I think a lot of people were not living consciously when Ed Bass is saying, we better do something out here and have some lessons to teach for the survival of the species. Is that an over-exaggeration?
Not at all. You know, Ed Bass and the people who started the original Biosphere 2 mission, I would say were definitely ahead of their time, visionaries, but their time has definitely come. And we can use the lessons that we learned from the original closed Biosphere 2 mission to think about how do we look at these ecosystems going into the future. And it is really all about how do we adapt, how do we learn to adapt to the changing world that we live in. And there's a lot of lessons we can learn through the science we're doing in Biosphere 2.
And, we haven't talked much about the Biospherians, but I am always blown away when I go out there and look at their living quarters and that they had to stay there and there was really no outside contact. I mean, I heard funny stories from Franklin. One of the funny stories we'll share just before the break is that, you know, how those annoying people that you want to choke at the zoo that are annoying the animals or throwing stuff at them or tapping on the window, people did that to the Biospherians. Oh my God. And he said one guy knocked on the door, got Jane Pointner's I want to make this story legend, attention. He just kept tapping. We know these people. And he got a Snickers out and he peeled the Snickers. It's like, is there no limit to how low you can go? I was like, Franklin was full of entertaining stories like that.
And there are great stories. And I highly recommend Jane Poynter's book, The Human Experiment, to get a real insider's view of that early experiment.
Oh, yeah. She does not hold back. Okay, yeah. Everybody, we have to go to another break. This segment flew faster than the last one. We have in studio Dr. Rafe Sagarin, Program Manager, Biosphere 2 Ocean, a member of the Institute of the Environment's absolutely expansive global growth team. I mean, it's unbelievable what Diana Liverman and Jonathan are doing out there. Please stay here with us when we come back. I'd like to talk a little bit more, or maybe a little bit, about Rafe Sagarin and how you started on this journey. And did Biosphere 2 Ocean come from you, or did you go to them? Please stay here with me.
I wish I lived.
Join us for a new Mrs. Green's World episode every Saturday at 12 noon Arizona time at MrsGreensWorld.com. All of our past shows are available as on-demand podcasts at MrsGreensWorld.com. Listen on your computer or mobile device. Connect with us on Facebook, Twitter, Pinterest, and Instagram. Mrs. Green's World is a proud member of the Dream Vision 7 and Glimmerglass Radio Networks. If you have questions about the show, write to us at info@MrsGreensWorld.com. We'd love to hear from you. More Mrs. Green's World next.
Hi there, this is Mrs. Green. The 2013 VW Jetta TDI is the sedan people love to love. It comes with a zippy turbocharged diesel engine that's 90% cleaner burning than previous diesel engines, and it goes farther on a tank of gas than a Toyota Prius. Chapman Volkswagen has a great selection of Jetta TDIs, so choose yours today at ChapmanTucson.com or in person at 4646 East 22nd Street in Tucson.
Do you dare to share? In 2009, the University of Arizona started its car sharing program. Today, students, faculty, and staff have access to a shared fleet of cars that includes 7 hybrids and even the zero emissions Nissan Leaf. Not only does car sharing give the campus community wheels, but it takes all those extra cars off the road too. Now that greens things up, doesn't it? The University of Arizona. Big questions, bold solutions, better tomorrows.
Did you know that even a donated doorknob can help Habitat for Humanity? Habitat's Habastore accepts donated items like furniture, building materials, and appliances. Donations come from commercial builders, malls, restaurants, hotels, and individuals like you. Then, items are bought by bargain hunters who come across the very things they are looking for, just like the right doorknob. The best part is that Habastore sales generate funds for building homes. Call 520-889-7200 or visit HabitatTucson.org.
Welcome back, everybody. You're listening to the Mrs. Green's World Radio Network, where we don't tell you what to think. We just want you to. And sometimes I think so fast that I have a 50-minute question. That's how I feel, Rafe. We have in studio Dr. Rafe Sagarin, Program Manager, Biosphere 2 Ocean, part of the Institute of the Environment as well, and author of one of my favorite books, Learning from the Octopus. So if you just joined us, Rafe is spearheading. He is the fearless leader for this new, very exciting, invigorating, robust project called Biosphere 2 Ocean to restore the ocean exhibit that's there now into, you know, maybe the eighth wonder of the world. Let's just really put it out there, Rafe. It's a big dream.
Yeah, well, we're going to call it the Desert Sea at Biosphere 2, and it's about transforming our large ocean environment into a living model of the Gulf of California, which is the nearest ocean to our Sonoran Desert, and which is completely tied up with the biology, the culture, and the climate of southern Arizona and the Sonoran Desert.
So talk about what feeling you want people to have when they walk through that door.
Well, I always have this feeling when I'm in the biosphere, that it's just the closest thing we have to the Chocolate Factory from Willy Wonka,
love it,
the Roald Dahl book. And I really want people to have that experience when they first walk into the living part of the biosphere and walk into the catwalk over the overlooking the ocean, of that just amazing feeling that the kids had when they first walk into the Chocolate Factory, and they're
that
just
wow factor,
blown away, that wow factor. And it really is a magical place in the biosphere. It's just like nothing else on Earth. And I want to captivate, you already feel that when you go in there, but really take it up a notch where you go in there and you see this cactus studded island in the middle of an ocean, and you start to think, why are there cactuses next to the ocean? And we start right away telling the story about this connection between the desert and the sea.
And I have to tell you this, because it just made me laugh, about when we went out with this group of parents and staff from Monzo and their kids. We spent a lot of time shopping because there's a great gift store, and that's not always the case. It's not full of crappy tourist items. I mean, yeah. I bought a shirt and it was made in the United States, because you can believe me, Mrs. Green was looking, but all the families, we were cracking up. Even the men were shopping and filling up things. So that's a part of the fun time when you have to be at a tourist attraction, so to speak, when you have time to look for things. And they were a lot of locally sourced things, prickly pear jellies, and a lot of things made in the area.
One of the things I love about Biosphere is all our missions are integrated, the research, the outreach, the teaching, so that, you know, if you're buying something from the Biosphere to gift store, it's going back to subsidize our research mission. Your admission price or taking a tour there is going back to subsidize the research mission, or to help subsidize bringing school groups in to do lessons on the ocean or the rainforest. So it's a really nice feedback system in that way, and not one of the original feedback systems that was thought about with Biosphere 2, but it's kind of an economic feedback system.
Do you have a breakdown, and I know I'm certainly not putting you on the spot, of where people come from, how many come from Tucson, how many come from Phoenix, how many come from out of town that are visitors, tourists to the area? Because it's not that far from Phoenix either.
Yeah, I don't have the exact numbers or percentages, but I do remember being surprised at what a large percentage of way out of town visitors we have, people from Europe and Asia, as well as people from all over the United States, and our local visitors from Phoenix and Tucson. It's really easy to get up there. It's a beautiful drive down the back roads from Phoenix, a beautiful drive up from Tucson. But then we have people who, they step off the plane and they want to go to the Arizona Sonoran Desert Museum. They want to go to Biosphere 2. And if they have the time, they want to go up Mount Lemmon and see the telescopes or Kitt Peak. And one of the College of Science goals, and Joaquin Ruiz, our dean and a head of Biosphere, is really committed to making Southern Arizona a hub for what we call geotourism.
Geotourism.
And we really have so many assets here with the Desert Museum, Biosphere, the telescopes, the Flandrau Science Center on campus, where you can come in, see this beautiful environment, and also learn a ton about the science behind this environment, whether it's the night sky, the desert, or even now our ocean, which is so near us and so important to our ecology.
And one of the things we talked about a little bit off air is capacity. So a challenge is money, but there is excitement in that. And there's no doubt in my mind that you're going to do whatever you set your mind to do. There's a lot of forces aligning for that whole energetic flow that's out there. It's buzzing with excitement. You walk in, there's something great going on. But the challenge of your roles to attract visitors, which is really one of the parts, it's to attract great researchers. It's to attract, think tanks like Scilog was out there. So how do you, as the fearless leader, what is the deal? Sleep is for sissies?
It is. It's amazing how, all the staff up at Biosphere 2, from the landscaping people to the scientists to the people dealing with visitor outreach, K-12 education, they're all so incredibly committed. And we hear about new projects all the time, and we want to jump into them. And we realize, how much more can I do? And we're all pushing the envelope. Our head landscaper also spends time whenever she can diving in the ocean and cleaning off the windows and that kind of thing. We have a great great community of volunteers. The dive shop in Tucson has been amazing through the
Franklin
years.
Franklin mentioned that too.
Keeping the water quality up, actually, you know, working with us to fix our filters, to clean the algae out. They're just tireless and they've done so much work. And, you know, what I'd love is to be able to give back to these communities, to have this great ocean, which can then become a dive site where people around the world can come and dive. A lot of people don't know, we are the only PADI certified open water site in Southern Arizona, the only one indoors and the only one up at 4,000 feet. So it's a wholly unique place where I think we'll attract a lot of divers to come if we can work that into our mission.
That's unreal. I mean, to think about it, and it's all under a dome. It's all the earth under a dome. So another thing that I want to put a plug for is the parents and grandparents and aunts and uncles that are listening, because do you know how expensive it is to go to the movies these days if you take your kids? So you can go to Biosphere. There are picnic tables. You can bring a picnic lunch, so there's no eating out costs, and literally spend the day there, reading the exhibits, going on a tour, walking the grounds. It is so affordable if you think of it instead of going to the movies, which, you know, if my husband takes my grandchildren to the movies and they buy any of the food, it's $40 for not good food. It's, you know, what you could do when you once in a while visit grandparents. But I think it's really, you might look at the ticket price and think, wow, and then think about what it costs to get into a movie and eat junk and be inside.
Absolutely. And it's much more than just the tour of the Biosphere itself, which is an incredible tour by really wonderful interpretive specialists we have. But the grounds, the view
amazing.
Of the backside of the Catalina Mountains is unbeatable. A day like yesterday or the day before were the most beautiful days I've seen in Arizona up there at Biosphere. It was just incredible to watch those surprise fall storms come in. There's beautiful grounds to walk around. We have tons of wildlife. We've been setting up remote wildlife cameras, and you would not believe the amount of wildlife activity almost around the clock that's going on out there at Biosphere.
And I'm laughing because of Franklin again. I mean, the timing was so perfect because these little boys are there, and they're putting in a camera to show where the javelina sleep. And he goes, and you can tell they sleep there because there's all the javelina poop. And these boys just... they just giggled. Here's this, you know, wonderful guy. So the javelina are coming around.
Yeah, absolutely. And like you said, you can spend the day there. You can bring your own food. We also have a great cafe from a local Oracle restaurant that brings in food. So we have good food there. You can just really enjoy the grounds, enjoy the biosphere. And there's opportunities to learn even without thinking about it, all around there. There's a wonderful display of a fallage, which is a Middle Eastern system of moving water around different villages that was given to us by the Sultan of Oman. There's exhibits on a model city. We're looking at Biosphere as a model of a real city, and how does energy move around that city? We're a test bed for solar technologies. We're looking at, can you put solar panels on all the mine tailing mountains that we have around here. So we have similar kinds of slopes, and we're looking at, does that work? So we have water harvesting projects. There's so many things going on. We have citizen science projects where you can look at the flowering of our different plants around the grounds and contribute data to the National Phenology Network, which is based at the University of Arizona. So there's so many opportunities, not just to see science happening, but to be involved in it.
And so there's two things I want to cover before we have to wrap up, which it's unbelievable to me how time does fly when you're having fun and thinking. One is the journey of Rafe Sagarin, including the learning from the octopus, which to me, it's almost like it was a look into the future that you may not have ever even imagined doing at Biosphere 2. And then the other part of, what are some real ways that people can help? I'm a big believer in the $5 method. So if 500 people are listening to the show and all they have is $5, do it. But if you have $500, do that too. There's a very easy way to donate online. So let's talk about both of those before we have to go off air, and what the website is, so I don't get yelled at by Matt Adamson because I forgot to say what the website is.
Yeah, so the website, before I forget, is b2science.org.
Okay, b2science.org.
Yeah, and my name is Rafe Sagarin. You can contact me directly. I love talking with people about science and about things I've written about and about this project. Any kind of contribution helps us with this project. Like I said, it's many different stages, so even small amounts of money are helping us tremendously now. Getting this Return to the Sea of Cortez exhibit donated by my friend Nancy Burnett was a fantastic addition to what we're doing. I want to give
it
a shout out to...
It just fell into place. It's so awesome that you got that.
Yeah, I want to give a shout out to Fishy Business, which is a new aquarium store down on Speedway. They're taking care of our smaller tanks, and they're really helping us, and they do a wonderful job with their tanks. And
Fishy Business.
With really thinking about sustainable ways of bringing wonderful species to people's tanks here. So they've been helping us out. We're getting all kinds of what we call in-kind help from different
right.
organizations and people, and we want to keep that coming. If you have a specialty, you know, with lighting or with signs, anything, all of that helps us. So we welcome, you know, any of our business partners
Many
and
ways
individuals.
To give.
Yeah. As for my journey, it's just been an incredible journey about that starts, you know, right with the ocean, with my early experiences there. And the book Learning from the Octopus is really reflects that. The book is about what do we learn from nature about how to be adaptable to any sort of problem that we're dealing with, whether it's terrorism or natural disasters or just running a business. I talk to all these audiences about all the secrets that are right in front of us in nature. And nature's been doing it for billions of years. And it's really been a journey I've gone through myself. I've been adapting the kinds of science I do. I've been adapting the kind of people that I work with. I don't just work with marine biologists anymore, but I work with first responders, and I work with soldiers, and I work with people who are running military bases to work on how can we adapt to our changing climate. But also I've adapted my own practices. I've completely changed the way I teach university classes because I realized I wasn't allowing my students to really thrive in the fast-changing world that we live in because I was just prescribing everything they were going to learn for a whole semester. Now I open up my classes and my students run the courses. So that was one
That's
adaptation.
That's the new paradigm.
I
mean, it's like the lecture series. People are so over that. They really want it to be, except for the happiness. It's one,
Which is great.
It's 1 hour.
Yeah.
It's 1 hour. It's not somebody standing up there pontificating for 3 hours.
Right.
I mean, I just threw that in because I think it's another outstanding example of the University of Arizona's commitment to our community and the globe. I mean, at all of the things that are going on there, you're opening the doors, saying to the community, come in, saying to the world, come in. And to me, it's working. I mean, it's just another example of those series are packed.
Absolutely.
So how can people get your book?
Learning from the Octopus is available at booksellers. I know that Antigone down in Tucson has been a great seller of it, but it's available on Amazon, Powell's.com, any online place you want to go. It's out there. And I have a site, adaptablesolutions.org, where you can find out a whole bunch of ways to bring adaptability into your life, whatever your challenge is.
So I don't know if everybody else was catching this. So Rafe is a husband, a father, a marine biologist, a nationally recognized public speaker. Am I embarrassing you yet? A researcher. It's like, let's go. And I keep thinking again of, okay, sleep has to be an option. You did not ride your bike here today. Probably that was because of a time element because you cycle up there. Another thing that people can do, there are thousands of cyclists in Tucson and probably nuts that would come from Phoenix on their bikes. These people drive 106 miles on their bikes.
Yeah, the bike ride either from Tucson or from Phoenix is beautiful. You can go the back way from Phoenix, have a beautiful ride. We have many staff members, and I hope to be among them, who might take our staff van up in the morning from Tucson and then ride their bike back down, which is a nice downhill ride. On the way back, we have some who go both ways on their bike.
I did my half marathon from the Biosphere 2, and it was, notice I said, my half marathon. There was one, and when I got to the destination, I said, well, I've done that. That's good, and it was downhill, thank God. But it's a beautiful sight. I hope that people listening from around the country, I'm going to have a guest on interviewing from Australia. I mean, people are really learning about the wonderful spotlight on Tucson from the Mrs. Green's World shows. And it's so, it's, I mean, I, like I said, I'm a little bit goofy about Biosphere 2 having just come back. So call to action, everybody. Support Biosphere 2 if you have a way to give of one of your gifts. Bioscience. Okay, say the website.
It comes up. B2Science,
because it comes up in my prompt immediately. Yeah. I don't have to look for it. B2Science.org. Very active Twitter community. Matt Adamson is on it. He's hysterical on Facebook.
Yeah, we've got a great Facebook feed.
Great Facebook.
Lots of photos from what's going on there, and great people.
Relevant,
jumping
exciting
on the discussion. I love it.
No kidding. So next week, everybody, another thought leader and person who runs a company that is walking the sustainable ethical walk, Alok Apadurai. I'm hoping that's his name, his last name. Fed by Threads, America's only made in America, organic, ethical, vegan clothing boutique that helps the planet with every purchase. Thanks for being a part of Mrs. Green's World. Make it a great green week. And Rafe, thanks for being on the show and for all of you are doing for the planet on our behalf.
Thank you so much. It's great to be here.